You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, SpyCast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about SpyCast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make SpyCast better, and you can help. We'd like to thank our friends at Movement for their continued support of SpyCast, and welcome Action Heat to the SpyCast family. I'll tell you more about these great products later, but first, let's meet our guests. So we're joined today by Ned Price, who is a lecturer at the George Washington University and a fellow at the New America Foundation. He previously served as special assistant to President Obama on the National Security Council staff, where he was also the spokesperson and senior director for strategic communications. Prior to that, Ned was an assistant press secretary and director for strategic communications on the National Security Council staff. And prior to that, he was at CIA, where he was a spokesperson and, before that, a PDB briefer and senior analyst covering a range of strategic and tactical issues. He publicly resigned from the agency in February 2017, after more than a decade of service, and we will certainly talk about why. And prior to joining the CIA, he was an associate at the Cohen Group, working under former Secretary of Defense William Cohen on a variety of public policy, nonprofit, and business initiatives. Welcome, Ned. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast.
Thanks for having me, Vince.
So we'll start where we do with many former practitioners, and then talk a little bit about what drove you to a career in national security and intelligence. Was this always the plan? Were you a budding high school student saying, I want to work for CIA one day?
I will have to admit, I was one of those foreign policy nerds even in high school, and I knew that I wanted to go into the field of international affairs, but as you know, that's a broad field, and there are plenty of opportunities under that umbrella. I went to school at Georgetown, and about 2 weeks upon moving from Dallas, Texas, where I was born and raised, to Washington, D.C. for college, was 9/11. And so I was a freshman at Georgetown, and that is when it crystallized. I don't know if on that day, but around that day, certainly, when it crystallized in my mind that the agency, that certainly the national security world, was where I wanted to end up.
There is a generation our age, so we look like we're relatively in the same ballpark. Their origin story will be 9/11. And it makes tons of sense, but it just, you know, I guess for our parents or our grandparents' age, it might be the Cuban Missile Crisis or World War II. I mean, for us, 9/11 really seems to codify a lot of our reasons for going into the business that we did.
I can't tell you how many, and quite literally, I can't tell you in some cases how many colleagues from college went to CIA, went to other elements of the national security workforce, enrolled in ROTC, took on careers in public service, broadly defined. And, you know, public service is not just working in the national security workforce. It's working for the greater good, working for humanity. And a lot of my colleagues, through both anecdotal chats and having caught up with them in the years since, that was a formative experience for them and one that really pushed them along in that direction.
Did you strategize your path to CIA? And the reason I'm asking that question is, do you have any advice for those that are thinking about a career at some point, college students or grad students, about a career at CIA?
I get asked that question a lot, and the answer is I really didn't. I worked hard in college. I studied abroad. I learned a foreign language. I took classes that interested me, and they happened to be in counterterrorism, for example, in regions including the Middle East that were of significant interest and still are of significant interest to the intelligence community. And I ended up applying online. I went to CIA.gov the fall semester of my senior year in college, filled out the application online, thought about for a while what I wanted to say in my cover letter, thought about the writing samples, everything that went into it. And several months later, I got what was called a conditional offer of employment, and that started me on the track there.
Am I right to think you started as a CT analyst?
Or that's right. Yeah, so I applied to be a counterterrorism analyst, and in February of 2006, I EOD'd, entered on duty at the CIA as a counterterrorism analyst. And so I was stationed in the counterterrorism center for those first few years I was at CIA.
Do you still use that training to kind of look at the world? Are you analyzing how we're doing against ISIS and Al Qaeda? I mean, Al Qaeda not getting a lot of attention anymore because of ISIS, but of course they're still the main threat because of kind of their targeting. I mean, from that time period, you know, we understood a lot about ISIS about Al Qaeda. Sorry, post 9/11. But are you worried? Should we be worried that we've kind of refocused on ISIS, which Al-Qaeda's mission is to reach out and touch us here in the United States. ISIS has always been regional versus, yeah, you know, international.
It's interesting to compare where we were when I started as a counterterrorism analyst in 2006 to where we are now. And you're exactly right. The threat at the time in 2006 was Al-Qaeda core, meaning the same group of individuals, many of the same group of individuals who attacked us on 9/11. Bin Laden was still alive. Zawahiri was still very much in charge. We saw an exodus, and this is something we focused on quite a bit, of young recruits from places like the United Kingdom, from other places in Western Europe, that worried us tremendously. And many of these individuals went to the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region, which if you can remember all the way back to 2006 through, you know, 2010, 2011, that was the focus of our counterterrorism efforts. And over the course of the years, scores of young men with access to the West in the form of Western passports, be they Brits or other Europeans, traveled to this border region, in some cases with pre-existing ties to Al-Qaeda. In some cases, they went there with no ties and they sought to link up with the group. And that was our focus, was identifying these people and making sure they were systemically flagged so that they couldn't be dispatched back to the West. And if you recall, there was this plot in 2006, and it was the first real big thing I worked on, launched out of the tribal areas of Pakistan and involving several of these British citizens of Pakistani descent who went back to the United Kingdom and were tasked with assembling liquid explosives to take on board airplanes heading to the United States. Mm-hmm. And that was really representative of the nature of the threat we faced. And now, you know, we're taping this just a couple days after the truck attack in New York City. And now the model of terrorism that we see, it doesn't emanate from Afghanistan, Pakistan. It doesn't emanate, by and large, from Al-Qaeda core. It doesn't even emanate from AQAP, the affiliate in Yemen that once Al-Qaeda core in the Afghan-Pakistan border region started to disintegrate, thanks in large part to U.S. counterterrorism efforts, really took up the mantle. Now it's ISIL. ISIL poses the biggest threat to the West, but it's not the same. The nature of the threat is different. It's evolved. It is not this same centrally directed
attack. Well, I was going to say Al-Qaeda was centrally planned,
yeah,
right? I mean, it's word comes down from on high to the minions in the field, and they carry out the attacks. Now everything is inspired versus directed from a certain central location.
That's exactly right. It was a franchise that, with the CEO still very much in a hands-on leadership capacity, to include hatching and overseeing some of these anti-Western plots. And now with ISIL, it's a very different model. Of course, there have been directed plots against the West that have emanated from Syria and Iraq, to include, it sounds like, the Paris attacks of a couple years ago. But that's not the norm. The norm is what we saw in New York City a couple days ago. One deranged individual having been poisoned, sometimes online, sometimes in person, with this ideology of hate, ISIL's message of Islam against the West, and taking that narrative and taking actions into his or her, in this case, his own hands. And the challenge here is that in the old model, you would have people traveling, you would have people communicating, whether it was with operatives in Pakistan or Afghanistan, or operatives in Yemen, or operatives in Somalia, and you would have these telltale signs, whether it was travel or communication or wire transfers, and you'd have clues to be able to identify these people. The challenge today is someone can sit in his or her basement or his or her parents' basement and read this stuff and internalize it and radicalize without even, in some cases, making contact with anyone else. And it makes it so much more difficult to identify these people and to try and thwart that kind of threat.
Well, and without a centrally located headquarters, there's no geographical sense of where these people are coming from. This guy was an Uzbek national. Uzbekistan's never even been mentioned as a part of any kind of travel ban. We certainly have a conversation about that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you'd have to ban the vast majority of the world because you could have even nations that aren't predominantly Muslim. I mean, the stands tend to be that have these lone gun wolf, whatever the hell you want to call them, that are inspired by ISIS. You could have a British national with a British passport coming to the United States. And I don't care how many countries you try to ban people from, it's not going to stop. I'm not trying to scare anybody, but that's kind of without a centrally focused geographical location to focus on, you're in a very different world now.
That's exactly right. And I think to put an even finer point on this, to eliminate the kind of threat we saw a couple days ago in New York City, you'd have to ban the internet. Even if someone was born here, lived his or her entire life in Middle America, they can still be susceptible to the same sort of online poison that seems to have infected this person's mind. I think when the facts of this case are all said and done, the national origin of this individual will be far less important than what he seems to have come across, whether it was online, whether it was radicalization in person with some of his associates. And that really gets at the challenge. It's not just people traveling. It's not just people being born in conflict zones and having those experiences. It's people who are able to get a glimpse of this vial and this poison online, and getting rid of that is an especially complicated endeavor when we have something in this country called the First Amendment.
Yeah. I mean, you also have to be much more looking like the Stasi under the Cold War or the Cuban CDR, where you have informants on every single block. I mean, your career at CIA spanned, I'd say, 2.0001 presidential administrations. Was the constant conversation, and others I've talked to have said this, I just want to, you know, see what your point of this on the constant conversation, especially in the CT ranks, of maintaining that balance between security and the kind of foundations of this country, the individual liberties that we all enjoy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And look, I think the pendulum has swung over the years. I remember one of my first days in the Counterterrorism Center, early 2006, I walked in there and there was a large poster, and the words there were, "Today is September 12th. And that was the mantra. That was the thinking. We were, you know, less than 5 years removed from the 9/11 attacks, but it didn't feel like 5 years. Mm-hmm. It didn't feel like 5 years in large part because every single day, every single hour in some cases, there were fresh reports of people planning to do very bad things somewhere in the world, and in some cases, very bad things against the United States. So there was this mentality there that we had to be on the ball all the time, and that there were these tremendously capable forces out there that were seeking to do us harm, and that was absolutely the case. you know, with the death of bin Laden, with other milestones in the counterterrorism campaign, the capabilities of some of these groups have been degraded. And I think with that, and with the Obama administration, there was another approach taken, and it was an approach that emphasized our values as well as our hard national security assets. And I think that really had traction, and it certainly gained traction with the success we were able to achieve in the counterterrorism campaign against some of these groups.
Well, let me talk to you a little bit about that part of your career at CIA, because you were an analyst, but you eventually would move into communications. And this is something we deal with a lot here at the museum. Because of 9/11, I think, and a rash of TV shows and movies, more people know or think they know, I'm putting emphasis on think they know, more about the world of national security and intelligence than they might have during other generations. Does this make the job of communicating to the public easier or harder when they have a potential baseline, but it might be a crappy baseline because they've watched too much Homeland, you know, or 24, where Kiefer Sutherland breaks the guy's finger and he tells them all about the plot? I mean, obviously, it's a double-edged sword, but, you know, what side of the pendulum does that fall on for you?
Right. I think nothing did more than 24 than to distort the image of the CIA. For people who have spent time there, the agency that they see in series like 24 or the movie Zero Dark Thirty, it certainly doesn't resemble the agency that I knew and that I think all of my colleagues knew and in some cases know. So there is sort of this dichotomy in what the public thinks and what the agency and our broader national security workforce, for that matter, is really like. And in some cases, when you have people who attack the agency on the basis of privacy and civil liberties, you know, I think their argument would be really weakened if they were to see what it's like on the inside, if they were to see the care with which the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, the entire constellation of national security departments and agencies take their mission, the respect they have for the rights of U.S. persons, the privacy of persons all over the world, consistent with their mission to learn about and to stop in their tracks very bad things. So I think the more the American people could learn about the true CIA, the more confidence they would ultimately have in the agency's mission and capabilities.
Well, and one of the dichotomies that I see is that you have people who believe the CIA is this all-powerful organization, the Jack Bowers of the world, and that, you know, or in Homeland where they save the world every time, or even the Bourne Bond thing. But also those that look at it as being like a cabal behind all bad things in the world, whether, you know, false flag operations or the Alex Jones InfoWars crowd. And there is a reflex, whether it's American culture going back to the beginning or anything, to distrust the intelligence community. A lot of it has to do with the secrecy that's kind of inherent in the community itself, but a lot of it, I think, has to do with kind of this pop cultural representation of CIA. Now you have an administration, and I'm not going to get political, but my guests can do whatever the hell they want to. And people are laughing out there when I say I'm not going to get political because they know who I am. Where people are now struggling with this idea of having to fact check everything and fake news and everything else. How much harder would your job have been as a CIA spokesperson today? And how much harder has it been made by those kind of personalities, the Alex Joneses of the world, and even those who make the CIA out to be this omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent organization that can kill anybody they want to with a drone across the world?
Yeah, it's interesting the strange bedfellows that have been forged in this peculiar political environment. You know, you have people like Alex Jones making common cause with people like Vladimir Putin. They, in some ways, are similarly responsible for this notion that the CIA is the global boogeyman. The CIA has its fingerprints on everything from the Arab Spring to uprisings in the streets of Moscow in 2011 to you name it. And I think that gives the CIA more credit than it deserves. And in some cases, it's in a lot of cases, it is just flat out wrong to attribute these actions, these developments, to the CIA or even the United States of America.
We'll come back to this conversation shortly, but first let me take a quick minute to tell you about Action Heat. As you might know by now, I originally hail from a warmer part of the United States. And if you're from Oshkosh or Lincoln or Boise or Fargo, you might think DC winters are a bit of a joke. Well, it's cold to me. And making matters worse, there are times our offices are colder inside than it is outside. So needless to say, I became the envy of the office when my shipment from Action Heat arrived. Action Heat makes the world's best heated clothing. That's right, heated clothing, powered by rechargeable batteries. It's the perfect solution to keep you toasty and warm, even in the most frigid winter weather. Their clothing provides toasty warmth and comfort for your whole body, including heated jackets, socks, gloves, hats, and even undergarments like long johns. You can stay warm and cozy from head to toe with Action Heat. And did I mention the heated socks? Action Heat clothing is engineered to safely and efficiently deliver heat via heating panels, similar to a heated car seat. They reach temperatures of up to 135 degrees and are powered by a rechargeable, low-voltage lithium-ion battery that lasts up to, get this, 12 hours on each charge. What's even cooler, the batteries can also be used to recharge your phone or any other gadget while you're wearing them. Perfect for any friend or family on your holiday gift list and available in men's and women's styles. Heated products that fit everyone's budget starting at just $39.99. And they've got a special deal for our listeners to save 15% off your entire order. Just go to action-heat.com/spy to check out everything Action Heat has to offer. That's action-heat.com/spy. Or you can even just use the coupon code SPY at checkout to save 15%. Stay toasty and warm while you enjoy all your outdoor activities this winter with Action Heat.
You know, on the broader question of what it would be like for the CIA, or what it is like for the CIA today in this current environment, you know, the job of the agency, and certainly the job of the public-facing offices within the CIA, the Office of Public Affairs, the Office of Congressional Affairs, today's atmosphere, I'm sure and I'm confident, has made their job all the much more difficult, because what we have seen emanate in some cases from the Oval Office are the very messages that our adversaries have put out for so many years, be it Vladimir Putin, be it other dictators around the world, be it Fidel Castro. It's once again, you see common cause between some of these figures. And to my mind, one of the most pernicious aspects of this all has been in some cases, the commander-in-chief's tendency to denigrate the work of the CIA, to call into question the analysis that emanates from the analytic ranks of the agency, to compare, as he did during the presidential transition, the agency and its brethren within the national security workforce to Nazis. And in fact, these were the same forces, in the case of the CIA, its predecessor, the OSS, that took on the forces of Nazism during World War II, that in many cases have worked against some of these similar forces around the world. So I think it really does a disservice to the men and women of the CIA, many of whom, all of whom, I would say, joined because they believe in the values of the Constitution. You know, we raised our right hands and we swore to protect the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And the CIA itself is now coming under attack from a domestic adversary in some cases.
You were a briefer to President Obama prior as a PDB briefer, part of it, not to Obama, to somebody else.
Okay. Yep.
But you were part, you know,
that's right.
You worked closely with him later on outside of the CIA.
Right.
And I'm wondering about kind of the politicization of intelligence that may or may not take place, not just for this administration, for others. Because I assume you tried to do all you could to divorce politics from the intelligence that was presented, the information that was presented. It's kind of human nature in many cases to bringing the thoughts and persuasions of the analytical teams, the collectors, et cetera, to the table. I mean, a lot of times I liken it to editing a textbook, right? It's supposed to be objective, but you're making the decisions about what to include and what not to include. Is that something that, you know, was ingrained into you at CIA as a briefer, you know, to make sure that you take politics out of the information that you're providing the policymakers?
Yeah, absolutely. In the case of my briefing stint at the agency, I was briefing internal customers. Mm. So the CIA director, the head of the what was called the Directorate of Intelligence at the time, the DI. So I wasn't briefing policymakers on the PDB. So that removed that element of it from my briefings. But I can tell you that one of the lessons that CIA analysts have really hammered into their heads, not quite day one, but almost day one, is the danger of politicization. This is an agency that in 2002 and 2003 lived this. The scars and the bruises and the wounds in 2006 were still fresh, and I know they were equally fresh in 2017. So it's a workforce that really gets its hackles up when it detects any effort to politicize what is supposed to be unvarnished intelligence information. And I saw this from the other perspective at the White House. And, I can speak to the Obama White House. There was a very firm and inviolable wall between policy and intelligence. That's not to say that intelligence always dictated policy decisions, but intelligence was treated as one of the inputs, and a sacrosanct input at that, in the policy discussion. There was no effort to shape intelligence. Sometimes the policy preferences wouldn't quite jive with the intelligence presentation that was put on the table, but that's just the way it went. There was no effort to shape the intelligence so that the two could mesh together.
Well, let me ask you about that, because how much of a complication does tasking or targeting, whatever word you want to use, complicate that? Complicate the mission of trying to separate policy from intelligence, because how a leader asks the questions, you know, and what you as a policymaker decide gets the attention is, even if they're not trying, it's adding a political slant to a degree. I mean, I'm using words that vernacular semantics, we can debate that all you want to, but I think back to Iraqi WMD. It's not, are there Iraqi WMDs, it's where are the Iraqi WMDs, right? That just that minor shift in semantics has massive repercussions. Yeah. And so the question the president asks, you know, what he wants to know, how he wants to know it, what his personal visions are for the future of the country, whether he cares a lot about North Korea or doesn't that help to shape what the intelligence agencies actually do on a day-to-day basis?
In order for intelligence to be relevant, there has to be a relationship between policymakers and intelligence officials. There has to be this free flow of questions and answers, questions emanating from the policymakers, answers coming back from the intelligence community. Otherwise, intelligence analysts are just writing papers that you would find at any Washington think tank that really have very little relevance and even less sway within the policy community. It becomes incumbent upon managers and leaders within the intelligence community, when these questions are asked, knowing that, as you suggested, they're being asked through a political lens, to ensure that the answers that are fed back are sterile and they're removed of any political bias whatsoever. And analysts within the CIA are especially attuned to this. So I rarely found it to be an issue, but it really is up to the briefers. It is up to the leaders of the intelligence community, the director, the deputy director, the head of the analytic division, to ensure that if a question is asked through a political lens, the answer comes back devoid of that.
I'm wondering, through your time there, especially at the White House, where you saw kind of the other side of this. Every president's had kind of different relationships with the agencies and different ways of being briefed. I mean, the stories coming out of the Obama administration was that he was a hardcore reader. He asked lots and lots of hard questions. Clinton loved to read raw intelligence. You know, Bush, for all the kind of, you know, caricatures of his intelligence, was actually a very good person to brief. We won't get too much into kind of the crayons and coloring book of the current administration. But that has to affect the way the relationship works as well. Those like the Clintons and others who really dug deep into this versus those who had a more of a, accept at face value explanation of what the agencies were giving them.
It does. It does. You know, I had always found, you know, as you said, George W. Bush to be very engaged in his intelligence briefings from the feedback that we as analysts received. When we wrote a PDB for President Bush, we would, without exception or almost without exception, get feedback. Sometimes it was as simple as, you know, the president read this with interest and was appreciative. Sometimes it would be, you know, the president found this outrageous and, you know, wanted X, Y, and Z done. And then, of course, as you said, President Obama had a different style, and he digested towards the latter half of the administration his intelligence on the iPad, often in the residence before coming to the Oval Office. And then he would sit with his national security team and a representative of the DNI to delve into a little more detail, ask any questions. But the Obama national security team really used those sessions as an opportunity to table policy issues. It was an opportunity for President Obama to get together with his national security advisor and his deputy national security advisors, along with the vice president and the vice president's national security advisor, to essentially scour the horizon and to discuss not only what was in that day's book, but also to discuss broader issues and to make decisions. It was the one surefire time during the day when the entire team was assembled in the Oval Office with a representative from the DNI. And granted, the intelligence representative would not engage in the policy discussions, but if there was a tasking to emanate from that session, if there was a factual question that came up, that representative could then take that back to the intelligence community. You know, I think different presidents have engaged with their PDB briefers, with their CIA representatives in different styles. But in some ways, we almost put too much emphasis on the first customer. The PDB is, of course, written for the president. But cabinet secretaries in multiple departments and agencies receive the PDB. There are PDB briefers who go to the NSC mm-hmm. on a daily basis to engage with policy staff there. There are others within the State Department who receive intelligence briefings. So, of course, you have the first customer, and that's the most important feedback and impression you're going to make. But there are various touch points between the intelligence community and the policy community where you can still get that feedback, and the intel analysts can get a sense for what the policy community cares about and is prioritizing, and the policy community can, just as importantly and probably more importantly, get a sense for what the intelligence community is seeing and hearing on the ground.
Let me ask you about the National Security Council, because you were intimately involved with it for several years. And when the Trump administration came in, there were conversations and there were actual reorganizations of the National Security Council, and there's still conversations about continuing to tweak it to make it more amenable to the administration. I saw this when it happened as, what the hell are they doing? Was I overreacting, or was this is that problematic to you as somebody who was there, as it was to me?
Well, you know, the National Security Council staff has undergone a lot of trauma and drama in the first 9 months of the Trump administration. The 3 or so weeks of the Mike Flynn rule were characterized by tumult and disorganization. And the waters have calmed a bit, as I understand, with H.R. McMaster now at the helm. But the real challenge is that the process, and really the National Security Council is all about process. There's, of course, the council itself, whose statutory members are set out in one of the first, and usually the first, national security directive to be signed by the president. But the staff runs the process of foreign policy. And so it's bringing together, or at least it should be, bringing together policymakers, along with intel representatives at the various levels, at the senior working level, at the deputies level, meaning the deputies within each department and agency, at the principals level, and then in cases where the president's input is needed, at the level of the National Security Council, where you have cabinet heads meeting with the president in a meeting chaired by the president, typically for the president to make a decision. The challenge has been that this administration, by and large, has not tended to favor process, and I think to their detriment. And what you have had, from what I've heard from those who have remained on the inside, is a failure to convene the deputies, is a failure to convene the principals, is a failure to have this routinized process through which very hard, challenging, difficult issues that involve equities that touch the intelligence world, the military world, the diplomatic world, the defense world, you name it, where representatives from all of these different entities are supposed to come around the table and tackle them head on at increasing levels of seniority. And now, at least for a large part of the first 9 months of the Trump administration, you have had a process where someone can just walk into the Oval Office, catch the president's ear and put a bug in his ear about an issue of foreign or domestic policy. Now, of course, when the new White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, came in, he's said to have limited that to some degree. To what extent that still occurs, I couldn't say. But the lack of process has really been the detriment to this national security process and to this administration's foreign policy. And I think you see that borne out, publicly at least, in some of the contradictory statements you hear from the president and then his Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State and National Security Advisors on some of the most prominent issues, like North Korea, like whether someone's going to be sent to Guantanamo Bay.
Right.
You name it, you just hear this discord and disarray that still exists today.
I mean, message discipline is non-existent, it seems. I mean,
it's public message discipline seems to be non-existent, but what really concerns me is that there is no policy process. The way it's supposed to work is that messaging flows from policy. You have a policy process that is routinized, that's organized. You come to a policy decision, and then oftentimes with the same people around the table, you say, okay, well, how are we going to talk about that publicly? When you don't have the process that arrives at a policy decision, you're, of course, are going to have a lack of message discipline across the board, and I think that's what we're seeing.
Well, in a lot of cases, the president is making policy, you know, when he wakes up in the morning and watches the news, and then the White House and the Security Council and the leadership, like Sarah Huckabee Sanders, are forced to double and triple down on policies that weren't necessarily thought out, and no SMEs were brought in. This was kind of whim policy.
It's almost like Fox and Friends has more influence than the PDB briefing these days. I mean, you certainly see tweets that are pegged to Fox and Friends. Fortunately, we haven't seen too many tweets that contain classified information, although there was at least one that seems to have contained highly classified information. But I think we can count our stars that there's only been one so far.
So let me ask you the question that I think that's key to this conversation. And to remind the listeners, you started your service at CIA under the Bush administration. You were certainly involved at relatively high levels with the Obama administration. But I want to ask you why you're no longer working for this administration. And from everything I've read, it's a very specific time period, a very specific speech that the president gave, President Trump gave, that put you over the edge.
Yeah, so just to set the table, I was at the Obama White House always as a CIA detailee. I was detailed from what was then known as the DI, the Directorate of Intelligence, to the National Security Council staff. And so the plan had been for me to finish out the administration. That would have been a natural point for me to go back to the CIA as an analyst. In the fall of last year, in the fall of 2016, however, I started to have a little bit of unease. And it was unease that was never at the fore, because what I was hearing from candidate Trump at the time, you know, I sort of dismissed as, well, this person will never be president anyways. We don't have to worry about this. But, of course, he became the nominee. And he started getting intelligence briefings when he won the Republican nomination, and his rhetoric was not at all toned down. In the third debate, as I recall, last October, he just casually dismissed the high confidence findings of the entire intelligence community that were released publicly on October 7th, that the Russians were behind this effort to meddle in our elections. And at the time, you have to remember that the public conclusion was not that the Russians were trying to help Donald Trump and denigrate Hillary Clinton. It was just the Russians were meddling. And yet he cast that aside.
We'll have more of Ned in just a moment, but let me take a minute to tell you about Movement. Movement Watches, again spelled MVMT but pronounced Movement, was founded on the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. The watchmaker's goal is to change the way consumers think about fashion by offering high-quality, minimalist products at revolutionary prices. With over 1 million watches sold to customers in over 160 countries around the world, Movement Watches has solidified itself as the world's fastest-growing watch company. And it's that time again. The holiday shopping season is here. Yay. With Movement, you can skip the crowds and standing in crazy lines and find a gift they'll love at prices that beat department stores. Thanks to Movement, all the gift-giving anxiety of the holidays can disappear with the press of a single button. These watches make the perfect purchase for just about anyone in your life, guy or girl. And remember, they start at only $95. So now let's finish your holiday shopping and get a Movement watch for someone on your list. Let me mention they start at just $95. At a department store, you're looking at $400 to $500 for a watch of this quality. Movement figured out that by selling online, they're able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing us the best possible price. It brings you classic design, quality construction, and stylized minimalism. And again, over 1 million watches sold in over 160 countries. So get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to movement.com/spycast. That's MVMT.com/spycast. Look, the watch I have is a really clean design. Seriously, I've been getting compliments on it ever since I put it on. So now is the time to step up your watch game. Go to movement.com/spycast. Join the movement. Well, let me stop for a second. You can continue on this idea of high confidence. I want to make sure that the listeners understand that this is not kind of the way we use high confidence in our normal day-to-day lives, that's about as good as it gets from the intelligence agency. They're not going to give you 100%, 1,000% surety. High confidence is basically saying we know.
There's a joke that it would be difficult for all 17 intelligence agencies to have high confidence in the color of the sky. Some would say it's blue. Some would say no. Today it's more turquoise. No, it's more of a denim color. But no, this was a high confidence judgment on the part of the intelligence community that the Russians were meddling in our election. And yet, the president, at the time, the Republican nominee had been briefed by our intelligence community leaders, and yet he consistently just cast that aside. Fast forward, he's the president-elect, and to go back to the rhetoric I mentioned before, he swung pretty hard at the intelligence community, compared them to Nazis, compared them to the Gestapo, which again, the predecessors to the CIA, the OSS in this case, had taken on during the Second World War. And then you're right, this rhetoric didn't really, he didn't tone it down, but on his first day, on his first full day in office, it was a Saturday after the Friday inauguration, then President Trump, went to CIA headquarters in Langley. And apparently this was an effort to smooth over
mend fences,
to smooth over any ruffled feathers. And he did so in a very distinctly Trumpian way. He stood there in front of CIA's memorial wall, which at the time had 117 stars carved into it. Each star, of course, representing a fallen officer who had given his or her life in service of the CIA, in service of the United States. And instead of pay homage to what was behind him, instead of acknowledge the sacrifices of the men and women in front of him, instead of speak to the indispensable mission of the agency, he bragged about the size of the crowd at his inauguration the previous day. He joked about going back into Iraq to steal its oil. He politicized the speech. He was overtly partisan and made a reference to the number of the people in the audience that voted for him. And, you know, all I could think about, and to be clear, I hightailed it out of Washington inauguration day and headed down to a beach to sort of decompress for a couple days after leaving the White House. So I was watching this from afar. But all I could see was the president and that wall behind him. And all I could think about were the officers with whom I served that were marked on that wall, including one very close mentor of mine, someone who really took me under her wing and taught me a lot of what I came to learn about counterterrorism and how you take on that mission. And so to me, that was an unforgivable sin. But with this president, it wasn't the end. He then, a couple days later, issued this first national security directive, and it named principals to the National Security Council. And among them was Steve Bannon. And removed from the statutory principals committee was the director of national intelligence and the director of the CIA, as well as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And so to me, the message was clear. This was an administration that was going to prize ideology over knowledge, over facts. And I felt, as a CIA analyst, someone whose charge it would be to analyze world events, to try to provide value-added and insights where I could, that if I were doing that job, at best, my reports would get to the White House or other policy centers where they would gather dust. Mm-hmm. At worst, they just wouldn't go anywhere, and I would be twiddling my thumbs day in, day out. And that wasn't how, you know, I wanted to I engaged in public service for a reason, and I didn't think that was the best way I could carry out that mission.
Just to dig down a little bit, because I think our listeners will know the name, the mentor you refer to is Jessica Matthews.
That's right.
You know, who was killed at Coast with, what, seven?
Jennifer Matthews.
That's right, Jesus, yep. Jennifer yep. Matthews. Was at Coast with, what, seven?
Six others.
Yep. So seven total.
That's right.
And that is... That's a story that's known by some, but you know that's pretty extraordinary. Where analysts are put in a position, you know, during this war on terror, to be at the forefront of some of these operations, and there are many who feel like you about that particular speech in front of that wall.
Yeah.
And the easiest thing in the world would have been just to have the camera in the podium in the other side of the room.
It
right.
still would have been inappropriate, yeah. but it yeah. wouldn't have been right. an affront to, you know, the men and women who gave their lives in service.
So let me ask you then about how has Mike Pompeo done? How has Dan Coats done? Pompeo, in my opinion, seemed to have been doing relatively well until recently, where he's somewhat, again, politicization seems to have come into the forefront here and some of the stuff he said publicly yeah. as director of CIA.
Yeah. You know, Director Pompeo doesn't speak like your typical CIA director, and that worries me. I mean, of course, his background is as a congressman. He served as chairman of the House Intel Committee. He knew the agency in that capacity, so he took the job and was able to take it running. But what worries me about him is the impression I get that he hasn't shed his partisan coat. And that he still approaches these things as a partisan lawmaker, as opposed to the head of the CIA, who is supposed to present facts and, in the case of covert action, present options to the White House. And what you hear from Mike Pompeo, I'll give you one example. I'll give you two examples, actually. At the Aspen Security Summit over the summer, he was asked about Russian meddling in our election. And his answer started off in the right direction. He said, yes, of course the Russians meddled in the past election, and the election before that, and the election before that, and the election before that. And it was quite clear that he was trying to make this seem as though it were just sort of run-of-the-mill Russian interference.
Right.
It was the same thing that, you know, in his telling, it was the same thing that the Russians did in the 1976 election when they tried to recruit a young Democratic activist to spy on Jimmy Carter. I mean, this is obviously qualitatively different than what we had seen before, but the director was not willing to admit to that, probably with an eye towards his boss. And one other example, in the case of Iran, you know, you hear him speak as if he were Nikki Haley, the U.S. representative to the United Nations, or as if he were the Secretary of State. He speaks of Iran not living up to the spirit of the deal. He has been a champion, as I understand it, both on the inside and if you listen to his remarks, his public remarks on the outside, of tearing up the Iran deal. And it's fine for CIA directors to have their own private political opinions. I think we can guess the politics of previous directors. But what distinguishes director Pompeo is that he seems to have no compunction with expressing these publicly. And I think in doing so, he really calls into question not only his own credibility, but also the credibility of the work product that the agency puts out. You know, the last director who had the same pedigree that director Pompeo has was Porter Goss. He was similarly a congressman on the House Intel Committee, and his tenure was tumultuous and short because he thought of himself still as a partisan lawmaker and never as the director of the CIA. I started at CIA when Porter Goss was in that role. The person who swore me into office was later indicted and sentenced to a couple years in prison, as I recall. There were leaks left, right, and center coming out of the agency. It was a very unhappy time with morale plummeting. And I'm concerned that if Director Pompeo continues down this course, his tenure will in some ways closely resemble that.
Well, and even something that seems benign, like the release of the Bin Laden documents, which as a historian, I'm like, sweet! We get to find out that Bin Laden had the Charlie Bit My Finger video on his computer and that he had something called Boobies JPEG or something. But this, there's a potentially a much more nefarious reason behind this. Particularly the idea of trying to tag or trying to connect in some way Bin Laden and al-Qaeda to Iran.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Look, when it comes to the Bin Laden cache, there were millions upon millions of files, some retrieved in hard copy, some retrieved from laptops and other media that were taken from the compound in Abbottabad in May of 2011. It took the CIA leading an interagency task force many, many months to sort of triage this information. And first and foremost, we were looking at information of intelligence value, information that could point to plots that could and would come to fruition, information that would help identify operatives that previously hadn't been on our radar, anything that was of intelligence value in those millions of pages. Once that process was completed, in 2014, I believe it was, the CIA, at the direction of the DNI, then undertook this process of, well, what can we declassify and make available to the public? Because a lot of this was of public interest. It had, as you said, tremendous historical value. And so over the course of 2.5 years, the CIA led an interagency team and went through, once again, these millions of pages to determine what could be released publicly. And so over the course of three tranches, the first coming in 2015, one more in 2016, and what we thought was a final one in January 2017, the intelligence community, the DNI, put out these files, which all of which were of public interest, which shed light on al-Qaeda's structure and capabilities and personalities.
Well, the Bin Laden bookshelf thing was fascinating.
Exactly. It was all of historical interest. And this was a process that was led by intelligence professionals. And the professionals reported back to the White House, where I was at the time, that, you know, we deem that everything of significant public interest has been released. Of course, it's a cost-benefit analysis because, you know, we have a number of good people who had to be pulled off otherwise pressing missions to sift through this.
Right, there's not like a collection of people ready to look at Bin Laden documents.
Exactly.
They actually pull real analysts off of their real jobs.
These have to be cleared CIA analysts to go through this material. And so the judgment was made that the material of public interest had been released, and the DNI announced in January of this year that, as they said, the book had been closed. And then lo and behold, Director Pompeo in October of this year tells a conservative audience at a Washington think tank whose reason for being had become to chip away at the Iran deal. He tells them that when speaking, when asked about Iran's ties to al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda's ties to Iran, he said, well, you know, we're going to have some more Bin Laden files that will shed light on this question. And so yesterday, the CIA followed through with that, and it just so happens that they gave an advanced preview of these files to the journal of this same Washington conservative Washington think tank. And so the director's motives in doing so seems to have been pretty clear. When intelligence professionals earlier this year said that they had concluded that the cost-benefit analysis dictated that, you know, we'd done enough and everything of significant historical value had been put forward, he decided otherwise and decided to take people off those jobs once again and to restart this mission. And, you know, we did learn that bin Laden has the Charlie Bit My Finger video, but, you know, whether the benefit of that outweighed the costs of these people once again returning to sifting through historical material, it's I think that's a question I'm not prepared to fully know. I do find it striking, however, that the CIA reportedly late last week objected to the release of decades-old records from the Kennedy assassination, right. And yet Director Pompeo prioritized this effort to get out additional files from the much more recent bin Laden documents.
I'm going to ask you about the congressional committees. I'm not going to ask you to deal with HPSI and Devin Nunes because we could be here all day. But one thing I actually find comforting to a degree is SSCI had always been considered above politics, much in the same way the Armed Services Committees used to be considered that way. And it seems that SSCI, to a degree, is maintaining that reputation, where you see Burr and Warner crossing the party lines, you know, regardless of what Burr might say in the public or Warner might say in the public. They seem to be working together fairly well, as does the rest of the committee, to try to get to the bottom of this without too much politics getting in the way.
Yeah, that's right. I think the CISI has been one of the very few bright spots in this. And, you know, I think Congress will, when the history is written of this period, really come away with a black eye. And, you know, HPSI's troubles, we don't even have to go into those, as you said. But I think you really have to go back to last fall, the fall of 2016, when a lot of this was coming to the fore. And the Obama administration has taken a lot of heat for trying to approach this threat and what we saw emanating from Moscow in an entirely nonpartisan way. And so the first step of the Obama administration in attempting to make this public was to go to Congress and was to go to both the Republican and Democratic leadership and say, this is what's happening. It would be a tremendous signal not only to all Americans, not only to all presidential contenders, but also to the entire world if, in a bipartisan fashion, you would come forward and attribute this activity to the Russian government and send a very clear signal that it wouldn't be tolerated. But Senator McConnell, in particular, had no need for that. And he, well, you'll have to ask him about his motivations, but it had always struck me that he didn't want to do anything that could further harm the chances of Donald Trump, who at the time seemed to be lagging far behind his Democratic contender. So fast forward to these multiple investigations, and you have at least one congressional committee that does seem to have a good degree of comedy. And I think it's right that there is, it does provide a measure of reassurance. I think the real question, however, will be just what the Senate is able to produce. If they'll be able to produce a joint report, if it will devolve into what we saw with the various Benghazi committees, mm-hmm. with majority and minority reports that say starkly different things. But I think it would send a very strong signal that this is not a partisan issue. It's not a political issue, that this is an American issue. It's about a threat to our democracy. If the Senate committee were able to continue that cooperation and put forward a bipartisan report that chronicles exactly what happened.
Well, your fears are certainly well-founded, and I think back to this exact committee, although with different members, putting out the torture report that was as bifurcated as it possibly could be, where one side said one thing, one side said the other. Hopefully we're not headed down that path moving forward. Let me shift gears quickly, because I don't want to keep you here for 3 hours, although we certainly had that conversation on my side for that long. But something I've always found dangerous, I'm ex-military myself, but it seems like it's gotten a little bit worse, and it may not be just this administration specifically, but the civil-military divide. I know you've written about this. I try to at least do some research on this. But it seems in this administration, and General Dunford, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has to remain above politics, but it's, I think the dynamic with General Mattis, or now Secretary Mattis, is pretty interesting. And I think historians are going to have a lot of interesting looks at the person who is part of a presidential administration as a civilian. He can be political if he wants to. Prior secretaries of defense have been very political in the past. But it seems like there's been almost an overt politicization of some of the other generals. I'm thinking of John Kelly very much in this circumstance. And Mattis has been able to stay completely above the fray, but thinking about stuff like the transgender bans and some of the other pronouncements about North Korea and others that have come out of the White House that have become official policy, as we talked about, you know, for the White House, and, you know, whether it's Sarah Huckabee Sanders or anybody else, and Mattis in the military saying, no, we're not going to do that. That seems unheard of, right? I mean, that
it's been tremendous to watch. And, you know, most of those decisions on the part of people like Mattis, on the part of people like Dunford, I have applauded and respected from a policy standpoint. You know, both came out as strongly as they could against, for example, the transgender ban, which a court prohibited from going into effect. Both came out and essentially tried to tamp down the hyperbolic statements emanating from the White House that, you know, we were on the cusp of nuclear war with North Korea, which I think we can all we all owe them a debt of gratitude for. So from a policy standpoint, it's been reassuring, but from a constitutional standpoint, from a standpoint of precedent, it's also a little concerning.
Yeah, no. So one of my left wing friends who are all like, they're so great. I'm like, if it was reversed, you wouldn't be saying that.
Absolutely.
And if you take politics out of it, it's not a good situation to be in.
Absolutely. And, you know, in some ways, this has been of the administration's own doing. They have placed uniformed military generals and retired generals throughout leadership positions. And look at H.R. McMaster. Yeah. He's in a really unique and in many ways odd position because he is still a currently serving lieutenant general. And he doesn't often wear the uniform now, but he is currently serving. And as a national security advisor, it's impossible, or nearly impossible, I would say probably impossible, to stay entirely above the political fray.
The politicization of stuff coming out of this White House, whether it's Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying we should never question a four-star general talking about the now White House Chief of Staff John Kelly. But this certainly depends on your team and talking about the rift here, because Trump has gone after Colin Powell and John Allen and Martin Dempsey and Barry McCaffrey, all of whom are four-star generals. I mean, you know, Wesley Clark hasn't been part of this conversation, but I'm sure Trump doesn't have good things to say about a former Democratic presidential candidate. So, I mean, this, we're digging ourselves into this, if you like the side of the politics of the general, you should follow the general. I mean, I thought we'd gotten beyond this with Douglas MacArthur, you know, going after Truman in the 1950s.
Absolutely. I mean, the precedent it sets on both sides, both in some cases military leaders, uniformed or not, standing up to a civilian administration in some areas, and then the administration in some cases engaging in this worship, this deification of military generals. It's tremendously dangerous for a country that has been predicated on the principle of civilian rule and of civilian rule of the armed forces. It's Article 2 of the Constitution that makes the President of the United States a civilian leader, the Commander-in-Chief. The Secretary Mattis had to be given a special waiver because the statutory period between his retirement and his nomination to be Secretary of Defense had not been passed. So I think it's a very dangerous thing on both sides, what we've been seeing. But what also has struck me, you listen to President Trump and his language, it's in many ways very scary. He talks about my generals. Mm-hmm. He talks about everything is possessive to him. He doesn't see a distinction between himself and the United States of America. You go back to the French Revolution and the old saying, you know, the I am the state is me. And I think it's pretty it's pretty concerning if you play that out. And I'm hopeful that we'll see a course correction with the next administration. But they've set a lot of dangerous precedents in a lot of different areas here.
Let me follow up, and we'll end up with a lighter question with serious implications, but it's a little bit lighter. If you were a leadership analyst for the Russians or the Chinese or the North Koreans or the Iranians or anybody who doesn't like us all that much, how much would you be loving life right now with the Twitter feed of Donald Trump? I mean, is there a leader in human history who has given out more information freely and voluntarily to people trying to psychoanalyze and figure out what the American leadership is up to? And you can't blame this on social media. This is not a, because Obama could have been all over social media. Even George Bush could have been all over social media. And they certainly held their policies much closer to their vest. I mean, this is a gold mine. Every single day, there's a gold mine of information being put out there about American policy and policy in our future from the President of the United States.
It's, you know, Twitter for him, and not just since he's been president, but if you go back and over the course of the years that he's used it, it's a roadmap to how he thinks, to what makes him tick, to what motivates him, to what makes him angry, to what makes him happy. It is, you know, it would make the job of a leadership analyst in some ways effortless, because there wouldn't be much analysis required. It's just going back through history and sifting through the thousands of tweets he has tweeted on every topic imaginable. So I think Twitter is a big element of this, but you know, he's also a president who emotes, and he's a president who really wears his emotions and his motives in some ways on his sleeve. And you know, I think, you know, I've written that if you're a foreign counterpart and you want to really sweeten the president up, all you have to do is compliment him. All you have to do is speak about investment opportunities in your country. Maybe how great it would be if they opened a Trump National Golf Course in an underdeveloped region that you have. Invite the sons to come out and to show them around.
And to shoot harmless.
Exactly.
You know, shoot defenseless animals.
Shoot large game animals. So it's this is the really the first time I think we've had a commander in chief who has provided both our allies and our adversaries with everything they need to know to win him over. And I think you've seen some leaders do that spectacularly. President Xi of China seems to have done that to some degree. President Macron of France, despite all odds, seems to have developed a level of kinship and a relationship with the president. And there are others who clearly have tried. I have a sneaking suspicion that when the president meets President Duterte of the Philippines in the coming days, they too will hit it off. They seem a lot alike in some ways. But it's good for our allies, it's good for our adversaries, it's not always good for us.
Well, Ned, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast. We truly appreciate your insight. And again, he was the one being political, not me. no one believes that. It's fine. Send your emails like you always do. We do our best. Appreciate it, Ned. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. We'd like to thank Movement Watches for continuing to support the SpyCast family and welcome Action Heat to the team. Remember, you can get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to movement.com/spycast and save 15% off your entire Action Heat order. Just go to action-heat.com/spy or use the coupon code SPY at checkout. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.